History isn't supposed to make us feel comfortable. And History for the Reckoning is a show that digs deep into the difficult eras and aspects of our shared past. If we don't want to repeat these travesties, we have to understand them. And that's why host Spencer Ford grapples with topics that others would rather forget. Each season of History for the Reckoning digs into a history that we've tried not to think about or even erased. Interviews with experts, historians, and people who lived through the history firsthand paint a fuller picture and restore those memories, even if they're not always the most pleasant. Season 1 is called American Concentration Camps, the story of World War II Japanese incarceration, and Episode 1 features a conversation with activist, author, and actor George Takei, most famous for his role in Star Trek. In his youth, he and his family were sent to camps throughout the U.S., and he joined Spencer to talk about his experiences. Find History for the Reckoning wherever you get your podcasts, or at historyfortherereckoning.com. Here's the trailer, and stay tuned for our first episode of Past Lives Season 2.
The government doesn't have anywhere to put 98,000 people.
We were literally treated like animals.
American Concentration Camps, the story of World War II Japanese incarceration. Season 1 of History for the Reckoning, a podcast that dives deep into the history that's hard to hear, but critical to understand.
A congressperson actually said on the floor, "This is the vaguest law I've ever seen."
Unconstitutionally detaining all persons of Japanese ancestry, alien, and what they cleverly called non-alien to avoid acknowledging that they were citizens.
I can't emphasize enough how improvised this was.
No habeas corpus, no nothing. It was so illegal from the beginning.
They sent you down the same barbed wire chutes that they sent the cows and the pigs through.
The searchlights and guard towers were looking in. They weren't looking out.
The American government went to 15 different Latin American countries who said that they would give up their Japanese citizens. The American government paid them to do this.
The only way to combat fear of the other is through empathy.
Through interviews with historians, activists, and people who lived it, we'll cover the history of this stain on America's past, its political and legal implications that resonate today, and learn how the Japanese-American community has fought for redress and healing in the decades since. So join me, Spencer Ford, as History for the Reckoning launches on February 19th, 2026.
I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to Past Lives. When we tell stories about the past, we tend to rely on textual sources, that is, writing, to provide us with the information we need to do so accurately. We know about Julius Caesar because of the existence of texts he himself wrote, as well as what contemporaries wrote about him and what later generations remembered and chose to preserve. We know about the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal because of the inscriptions and images carved in his name on the walls of his palace. We know about Olaude Equiano because of his autobiography, Interesting Narrative, and a few other bits of written material about him that have survived through the years. At its most fundamental level, the study of history is a pursuit built on the use of written sources. As historians, we live in a world of words, carried down in their multitudes through centuries and millennia in the form of painstakingly copied manuscripts, precious papyri and wooden tablets, and carvings made in stone. We are grateful for each and every one of those scraps, be it a moldering account book or the most beautifully illuminated manuscript, because each one is a lifeline to past worlds and lives that would otherwise be lost. As a body of evidence, however, writing has some real limitations. The vast bulk of what survives, especially from more distant eras, comes from the pens of elite men and those most closely associated with them. Literacy was far more restricted in the past than it is today, a technology largely, and in some cases exclusively, reserved for the wealthy and powerful. We have plenty of Demosthenes' speeches from classical Athens, but nothing from the thousands of miners toiling in the cramped galleries at Laurion. Educated churchmen wrote at length about the First Crusade, but the words of illiterate soldiers and servants who waged the nobles' wars and cared for the nobles' horses are conspicuously absent in the historical record. These limitations become all the more prevalent the further we go back in time. There are whole periods and regions from which we have absolutely no written material at all. Writing, as it turns out, wasn't actually necessary for many complex societies to exist and function. And since the invention of writing, billions of lives have come and gone and left zero trace in any written text. In the more distant reaches of the past, nobody was writing anything at all. But writing isn't the only body of evidence we have access to that teaches us about the past and the people who populated it. There are other sources of information that we can use to build out the stories of those billions of lives that were lived before writing appeared. The material remains of the past are everywhere around us, ranging from structures like the Great Pyramid to sediment samples containing pollen that was laid down thousands of years ago. People discarded fragments of broken pottery, dropped coins, and deliberately buried their dead, often with some of the objects they used or valued in life. The study of those material remains is what we call archaeology. And in this exciting new season of Past Lives, archaeology is our entry point into human stories that have previously gone untold. Welcome to Bodily Experiences. In this new season, we'll be utilizing a specific subdiscipline of archaeology called bioarchaeology to tell these stories. Bioarchaeology is the study of organic remains, and even more specifically, we're using the bioarchaeology of human remains. When people die, we bury, burn, or expose their remains in a grand variety of ways, with the end result quite often being a physical body preserved in some form, as a skeleton, cremated remains, or less commonly as a mummy or bog body. Whatever form it might take, the physical remains of a human body are an extraordinarily informative source of information about that person's life. Remains may no longer have life, but they are what is left of that person, even more than the objects they used or the words, if any, written about or by them. The body gives us insights into aspects of our collective lived experience that no other type of evidence can. Injuries, daily aches and pains, nutrition, parasites and diseases, the circumstances and causes of death. The kind of information that either rarely or never appears in written source materials. When we combine the insights gleaned from human remains with more traditional archaeology and whatever written texts exist about a given period, people from the past suddenly spring into three-dimensional life. This is the approach we'll be taking in this second season of Past Lives. Each episode will be a bioarchaeological microhistory of an individual that we know through their remains. Those remains contain not just one, but many different sources of information about that person's life, as well as their death, their ancestry preserved in their DNA, where they grew up and how they moved around, locked into the isotopes of strontium and oxygen in their bones, what they ate, captured in isotopes of carbon and nitrogen, what activities they regularly engaged in, what major injuries they suffered, and when soft tissues like muscle and skin have been preserved, even what tattoos and other markings they received. All of these data points combined speak volumes about who a person was in life. We know so little about the vast majority of people who lived on this planet before us. But there's good news. We've entered an extraordinarily exciting new phase of research on our shared past. In the past couple of decades, the field of archaeology has been totally transformed through the use of the tools I just mentioned. Paleoclimate studies, environmental analysis, ancient DNA, isotope studies, and 100 other methods have radically expanded the boundaries of what we can learn. A striking number of those new tools rely on data drawn from human remains. In fact, the great achievement of this new archaeological science is, in my opinion, the fact that it turns human remains into a full body of evidence that we can read, like a text. What's most exciting about these developments is that they represent unprecedented access to entirely new forms of evidence about the past. When we study texts, especially before the past few centuries, what we see is what we have, and that is all we know. We are unlikely to find extensive new narrative histories of the Roman Empire, chronicles of the First Crusade, or philosophical discussions of China's warring states. There might be some chance discoveries here and there. The scrolls found at Herculaneum are giving up some of their secrets after almost 2,000 years. New inscriptions are discovered and published. More papyri are found in Egypt, and so on. But truly exceptional textual discoveries are rare, with most just nibbling around the edges of the story. We read the scrolls and inscriptions and papyri and then slot them into the plot as we already understand it. These additional, minor discoveries add a new flourish to the story now and then, maybe some additional texture, but rarely do they alter it. With the tools of archaeological science in hand, we're now able to tell entirely new stories with detail from what used to be nothing, digging into the history of human life in ways that were previously inaccessible. Now, we can answer questions that were previously unanswerable. The origins of migrants, the health impacts of the transition to farming, the final meal of a 5,300-year-old murder victim, what it was like to fight in a battle during the European Bronze Age, and how building the pharaoh's tombs in the Valley of the Kings physically affected the Egyptian workers. Over the next several months, we'll meet people who lived in times and places we could never before explore. Skeletons of those who wandered the forests of Mesolithic Europe more than 7,000 years ago. Mummies preserved by the aridity and the heat of the deserts of Inner Asia 3,000 years ago. Mass graves of English dead who fell during the Wars of the Roses. Those left slain during bouts of violent tribal warfare on the Great Plains before the arrival of Europeans. And many, many more. Welcome to Bodily Experiences. The approach I'm suggesting here isn't novel within the study of human remains. I'm extremely fond of a genre of scholarly study called the osteobiography, writing a person's life story from their bones, hence osteo, or other physical remains, rather than the textual accounts that relate to that individual. The archaeologist John Robb has been an advocate for this method for decades, and published a paper with Lauren Hosek in 2018 laying out some of the basics. As the name implies, osteobiography focuses on the individual rather than a large statistical sample, as is more typical in cases of biomedical research. Robb compares osteobiography to a clinical case study fleshed out with ethnography and direct observation. The result is a microhistory of that individual. We may not gain access to their aspirations, dreams, or character. The life of the mind is lost to us, except insofar as it leaves physical traces in the archaeological record. But we nonetheless can know so much about a person just by their remains. We live in our bodies, experience the world through them, and ultimately die in them. That is a whole arena of human action. And for most of us, our immediate bodily needs are of far greater importance and concern than thinking about the nature of divinity or ethics. Our stomachs growl with hunger, our backs ache after a long day of work, we suffer fevers from viral infections, and watch as our immune systems try and fail to deal with cancerous tumors. A biography built on that kind of visceral information functions rather differently than one rooted in the development of an individual's personality and worldview. The reason we can tell these kinds of stories using the tools of archaeological science is because the body is plastic. I don't mean that literally, but figuratively. The body remodels itself in response to the stresses it experiences over the course of a life. Malnutrition or severe disease in childhood leaves telltale markers on teeth and bone. Broken femurs and fingers heal but show visible thickening around old fractures. Trauma of all kinds leaves marks. So too do actions that aren't traumatic per se. Repetitive movements carried out over years and decades, like grinding grain or carrying a basket on one's head, shape the muscle attachments on a person's limbs. The lifelong archers on the warship Mary Rose, whose bones rested at the bottom of the English Channel for 500 years, are easy to spot. They had massively overdeveloped muscle attachments on their dominant sides, the result of exerting hundreds of pounds of force dozens of times per day for years. Think about your life and the experiences you've had. Sitting at a desk? That's going to show up in the patterns of wear on your vertebrae and the muscle attachments in your hips and lower back. If you played softball or baseball throughout your childhood and threw with your right arm that whole time, there will be differential patterns of development from one side of your body to the other that reflect those repetitive stresses. That time you stepped on a hand truck and it popped up and broke your nose? Well, that left a telltale sign of a nasal fracture on your skull. That one may just have been me. Even the superficial appearance of bones, when examined closely, reveals huge amounts of information about the person they belonged to. Around 20 years ago, the archaeologist Joanna Sofair wrote a book that I'm very fond of, called The Body as Material Culture. In it, Sofair talks about how the objects we make and use, our material culture, vary based not only on their purpose and function, but on other, less tangible things like aesthetics and traditions, practices embedded deep in our cultural DNA. Sofair's insight is that we construct our bodies in the same way, not just in an abstract sense, but literally. Patterns of behavior aren't purely functional. They're rooted in our sense of how we're supposed to act. Today, very few people who live in what we broadly call the Western world squat down onto their haunches on a regular basis. And that's not because most people living in the United States and Western Europe inherently lack the physical capacity for it. It's because it's not a standard cultural behavior. That's not the case in a great many other parts of the world where the deep squat is just a thing people do. Since those repetitive behaviors are one of the major forces that shape the body, as we discussed, the patterns we see in human remains reflect not just individual choices, but broader cultural practices. This makes bodies a particularly intriguing lens through which to discuss people and the societies that shaped them. If all of the men in one archaeological context show evidence of violent trauma, but none of the women do, we can say something about who in that society was expected to engage in violent behavior. By contrast, if women repeatedly show evidence of fractured right arms and broken noses, but men don't, then we're almost certainly looking at a situation in which domestic violence toward women was normalized. Few societies before the very recent past, and by recent, I mean the 20th and even the 21st centuries, produced written texts providing accurate data on intimate partner abuse, and even reconstructing some vague sense of the attitudes about such behavior is difficult. Through human remains, however, that facet of gender relations and gender hierarchy becomes clear. And that's just one example of a topic that only appears accessible when we read the body as a text. When we move beyond the surface of the skeleton or preserved soft tissue to the isotopes and DNA still waiting inside the bone, we can learn even more. Ancient DNA is the poster child for this revolution in archaeological science, both because of its genuinely transformative impact on our understanding of the past, but also because of some fantastic public relations work that blasts out news of findings far and wide. While human remains degrade over time, tiny, damaged fragments of DNA inside the bone can linger for hundreds, thousands, even tens of thousands of years. Under perfect conditions, it can last even longer. Scientists have recovered DNA from a mammoth more than a million years old. Archaic humans, 430,000 years old, from the site of Cima de los Huesos in Spain, have given up the secrets of their genetic code. DNA can tell us all sorts of things, from propensities for developing particular ailments, to one's hair and eye color, to whether a person can tolerate lactose. That's all valuable information, and we're happy to know it, but we can go even further than that. Because we inherit our genetic material from our parents, who inherited theirs from their parents, and so on back through the generations, DNA is fundamentally a record of our ancestry. Who had children with whom? Our ancestors' DNA is preserved within our own, chopped and sliced into smaller and smaller pieces as the generations pass, but it is still present. And since the number of ancestors we have doubles every generation, 4 grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents, 128, 5 times great-grandparents, 4,096, 10 times great-grandparents, you get the idea, every sample of human DNA offers access to the record of thousands upon thousands more people. Each of us contains the story of entire populations written over thousands of years in our genes. Ancient DNA is extraordinarily valuable for understanding the big picture of ancestry, how large groups of people moved and interacted and developed over extremely long periods of time. But it can also provide more intimate portraits of life. Analyzing the DNA of people buried in Lombard cemeteries on both sides of the Alps in the early Middle Ages revealed that they were related, forming a kin group that persisted for generations at the top of Lombard society before and after their migration to Italy. At one mass grave in present-day Poland, dating from around 5,000 years ago, ancient DNA told us that those who buried the dead carefully placed mothers with children, spouses together with their offspring, and siblings side by side. That insight paints the whole archaeological site in a different light. There are so many ways to get information from a body, or what remains of it. The possibilities are truly endless. As we grow from infancy to adulthood, bones in different parts of our bodies stop growing at different times. When they stop growing, they lock in the isotopic signatures of the elements found in the foods our bodies have consumed to build those bones. Strontium and oxygen from groundwater, carbon from meat and grains, nitrogen from seafood, and so on. Countless different tiny traces are carried and deposited by the consumables that keep us alive. Some bones, like our teeth, cease growing quite early, so analysis of isotopes from dental enamel tells us about childhood diet and location. The spongy, endlessly renewable collagen of the ribs, by contrast, reveals more recent activities. Among many other applications, these tools help us identify migrants in the archaeological record, people who grew up in places with an isotopic signature that doesn't match where their remains were found. Individuals with different signatures in their teeth, rib collagen, and location of death thus spent time in at least three different places. We can reconstruct miniature life histories of migration through isotopes alone. But the best part of all this, from my perspective, is that we can use not just one, but all of these tools together to read remains as text. For the episodes of this season of Past Lives, we don't have to be limited solely to paleopathology, the study of trauma on the bones, or ancient DNA, or items found in a grave. We can use all of them together, shining many different beams of light at once to illuminate the life of an individual. In some cases, we even have textual evidence to go along with what we find from human remains. The result is a comprehensive portrait of a past person's life, drawn first and foremost from the evidence of their bodies. Next week, our first narrative episode will focus on an extraordinarily brief life, that of an infant whose remains were found under a collapsed rock ledge in Montana in the 1960s. This poor baby died roughly 13,000 years ago, a member of a group we know today as the Clovis people, who were among the first to arrive in the Americas. A few weeks later, we'll travel to what's now Germany around 9,000 years ago to meet a woman from the European Mesolithic. Based on the artifacts buried with her, she may have been a shaman. Breaking our usual pattern of focusing on the otherwise nameless, we'll encounter an Egyptian pharaoh, Sekenenre Tau. Unlike many of his fellow rulers, Sekenenre Tau fell in battle, his skull crushed by an axe, something we know because of his preserved mummy. Later, we'll meet a tattooed Scythian princess and a woman afflicted with leprosy in early medieval Britain. I could not be more excited about venturing into this world, and I hope you'll come along with me as we explore bodily experiences. You can support Past Lives by subscribing to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews with scholars, our book club, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thanks so much. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. This has been Past Lives.